Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We currently have bonus episodes on our reactions to the Oscar nominations and our thoughts on the latest season of True Detective, Night Country. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with...
Genevieve Kosky.
Keith Phipps, but for the sake of this recording, call me Keith Podcast Phipps.
Well, Tasha Robinson is away from us this week, but she's not mixing with college-age boys in Fort Lauderdale or Malia, which is a big relief to us based on this week's movies. In her place, we're excited to put on our Coke bottle glasses and play a little dialectic jazz with our special guest, Mariah Gates. Mariah is a freelance film and culture writer here in Chicago, whose work has appeared at RogerEbert.com, Vulture, The Playlist, and other fine publications. She also has a Substack newsletter called Cool People Have Feelings Too, highlighting movies directed by women. Hello, Mariah.
Hey, great to be here.
So it's only mid-February, but the year already feels long. So we've decided to take spring break a little early so we can all pile into cheap motel rooms by the pool, have some beach time, get our fake IDs out, and maybe meet that special someone. Surely the films we're talking about this week will reinforce this excellent plan of ours, especially for the women in our group. Right, Genevieve?
Not so sure about that, Scott. The new British coming-of-age film How to Have Sex, written and directed by Molly Manning Walker, starts with three teenage girls heading to the Greek Isles for the best vacation ever. But it doesn't go quite as planned, at least for one of them. In the resort town of Malia, which looks a bit here like a European Cancun, the trio arrive looking for a week of drinking, clubbing, and casual hookups. But one of them is a virgin, and navigating these shark-filled waters proves to be especially perilous for her. How to Have Sex is about an environment where a combination of peer pressure, alcohol, and coercion can erode the boundaries of consent for young women who are just looking to have a good time. But these problems aren't unique to 2024. In the seemingly frivolous 1960s spring break romp Where the Boys Are, four women from a chilly Midwestern college head to sunny Fort Lauderdale looking for fun and romance too. But they each have their own trouble meeting a partner they can trust, and things get a whole lot darker than a movie like this would lead you to suspect.
So this week, we'll hop into the Next Picture Show convertible and head south to Fort Lauderdale in search of handsome Ivy Leaguers in Where the Boys Are. Then we'll keep the party going in Malia next week with How to Have Sex. And then we'll probably never leave the house again. Please stay with us.
Girls! Girls! Girls!
Where are you going?
The screen jumps for joy with Glendon Swarthout's inside story of those uproarious Easter vacations.
Gentlemen, the city of Fort Lauderdale is once again under fire from the north. Now, Fort Lauderdale is not the only community to be invaded at this time. In Palm Springs and in Newport, on the beaches of the Mid-Atlantic, the students of America are gathering to celebrate the rites of spring.
Where's the beach?
According to this, it's across the street.
Join the fun as the gang tears loose where the boys are. There's plenty of room, all the comforts of home.
Anybody here from Princeton?
Come on, live it up with their laugh sessions, their romantic sessions, and those way-out jam sessions.
You gotta turn on the sunshine, you gotta push the blues away.
I want to start this keynote on Where the Boys Are with the opening lines of Bosley Crowther's New York Times review, written in January 1961. Crowther writes, quote, "As fast as they are with the wisecracks, the cute situations, and the gags in Joe Pasternak's new color picture, Where the Boys Are, you may wonder that this observer is not overwhelmed by the mirth. The reason for that is simple. There is not much to laugh at in this film. There's a funny scene toward the middle in which a bunch of college kids, boys and girls who have joined the mass migration for spring vacation to Florida's Fort Lauderdale, plunge wildly into a glass tank full of water on a tropical nightclub stage in pursuit of one of their buddies who has been attracted by an aqua dancer's lungs. There's good, broad, healthy young folks' humor in this one isolated scene, and it is significant that it drew the loudest laughter from the first audience yesterday at the music hall. But the rest of this widescreen observation of the springtime mating habits of college kids in their long-ordained gathering place in Florida is a little bit shocking and sad. End quote. Amen to that, Mr. Crowther. The funny scene described in this review is one of those ostensibly wacky moments when all of our drunken young revelers fall into the water fully clothed. And yet it's prompted by a guy who's so aroused by an underwater dancer that he dives into the tank to grope her because he can't control himself. It should also be noted that he's one of the good guys and where the boys are. A little wacky and sex-obsessed, but ultimately a project worth taking on. There may be 20,000 college kids descending on the beaches of the Atlantic Ocean for 2 weeks, but the dating pool in Fort Lauderdale is one shallow, muddy puddle. Nevertheless, a beach vacation sounds divine for four Midwestern college women who need a break from classroom stress and the snowstorm that has given them all the sniffles. In the class discussion that opens the film, Merritt, the smartest and most forward-thinking of the group, argues with her teacher about premarital sex, suggesting that the post-Kinsey generation has different ideas about relationships than the generation before. But the friends who join her on a trip to Fort Lauderdale have the much more old-fashioned goal of finding a mate. As one of them, Tuggle, explains, quote, "Girls like me weren't built to be educated. We were meant to have children. That's my ambition, to be a walking, talking baby factory. Legal, of course, and with union labor," end quote. Merritt and Tuggle are joined by Angie, a hockey player can sing, and Melanie, who sets her sights on Ivy Leaguers. There turns out to be a guy out there for each of them, but they're not all winners, to put it mildly. Merritt, played by Dolores Hart, flirts with a rich Brown University player named Ryder, played by George Hamilton, but she's wary of his aggressive courtship. Tuggle, played by Paula Prentice, picks up and tolerates the obnoxious T.V. Thompson, played by Jim Hutton, a Michigan State student who hitchhikes to Florida and walks around with a police scanner. He's also the guy who dives in after the Aquanancer. Angie, played by Connie Francis, hooks up with a half-blind jazz musician, played by Frank Gorshin, and poor Melanie, played by Yvette Mimieux, gets involved with a couple of supposed Yaleys who seize on her vulnerability and naivete. Melanie's odyssey with these two men, named Dill and Franklin, alters the tone of Where the Boys Are to startling effect. Working from a novel by Glendon Swarthout, a writer better known for war stories and westerns like The Shootist, Where the Boys Are has an almost anthropological tone, beginning with a piece of narration about the 20,000 students who swarm to Fort Lauderdale every year, with the male of the species soaking up sun and beer, and the female of the species looking out for the boys. And while the film isn't reactionary, it does go to extraordinary lengths to show the power imbalance between men angling for sex and women trying to fend them off, or, in Melanie's case, trusting that their sexual interest will lead to something. In its darkest sequence, Melanie walks into traffic with a dress torn, having been left in a seedy motel after being raped, and later wakes up in a hospital upset that she isn't dead. Clearly, this is no ordinary spring break movie, though Where the Boys Are was a sizable low-budget hit for MGM. The film is, quote, "a little bit shocking and sad," as Bosley Crowther wrote, but it's also unusually thoughtful, particularly as Merritt sorts through all that she and her friends have experienced. At the hospital, Merritt grows frustrated with Ryder, who's perhaps the best of the men in the film, but has nonetheless pushed himself on her and left her confused about his sincerity at times. Speaking of men, Merritt tells him, quote, "I blame all of you who think of a girl as something cheap and common, just here for your personal kicks. Look, she got mixed up with the wrong people," he replies, to which her answer is, "Have you met any right ones lately?" We'll talk about the wrong guys and the wronger guys after the break.
What is it between you and that TV character? A potato chip orgy every day?
Not every day, no. Sometimes we buy pretzels. What's the difference so long as you're having fun?
This is beginning to sound serious, is it?
If you mean has he measured me for a ring, no. If you mean if he ever suggests it, I'd think a long time. Like about 20 minutes before flinging myself on his chest.
You'd get married? Well, what about school?
Girls like me weren't built to be educated. We were made to have children. That's my ambition, to be a walking, talking baby factory. Legal, of course, and with union labor.
So I had never seen Where the Boys Are before this pairing, and I have to say I was a little shocked by it. Were you shocked by it too? And I guess this is a question for Mariah. How much does it deviate from other films of its kind? Because I don't think I've experienced that many.
Well, first, I wanted to share, the audience can't see this, but I actually own Where the Boys Are on Blu-ray. So I've seen this movie a lot. And what's interesting is it's coming at this time where you're coming out of the 50s and you're coming out of the like very repressed post-war era, right? And sexual mores are changing and you're starting to see it first in literature and then in these adaptations. And the adaptations are a little sanitized. Like, for example, in the book Where the Boys Are, there's a whole section where they're like raising funds for Castro and his revolution. Not in the movie, but the sex is there and the consent lines are there. And you saw this in a lot of films in the late 50s, usually college age or just out of college going on an adventure. So you had, or getting into the workforce, you had something like The Best of Everything, which is another group of girls living together in a hotel and working, and bad things happen to usually the most innocent person. You have things like Rome Adventure. You have Three Coins in the Fountain. I think what's interesting about Where the Boys Are is it's the first one to really look at, these are basically teenagers, you know, they're all freshmen in college, as opposed to those earlier films where you're like, oh, you're to use that horrible phrase, free, white, and 21, right? These girls are not 21. They are teenagers. And it's really showing where the country's going to go in the 60s, where you had teenagers starting to experience the freedom that usually you would see in movies with, you know, 22-year-old characters, right? And then it started this whole genre of the beach party movie, which became like stripped everything away, all of the like politics, all of the questioning of the changing values of young people into just, you know, frivolous, frothy party stuff. And so I think your thought of coming to this movie thinking it's just going to be that is because you watched probably some of the films that came later that really stripped everything away. But there's this really rich period from like 1956 or so to 1962, where you had these films that are really trying to show how like the Eisenhower era is over and everything is changing in this country. And so you get something like the end of Where the Boys Are, where one of the characters really goes through the ringer, and you really don't expect that in like a movie. If you watch the trailer, you know, you would not expect this at all, because it's just hijinks in the trailer.
Yeah, I think if you come to this movie backwards, like I did the first time through the beach party movies, you're like, you get to this, like, what am I watching here? And is this better or worse? I'm not even sure. I think Scott's keynote kind of touches on the reading where this is secretly a movie about how awful men are, which I think is a very strong reading of this film. But it's also sort of a movie about how good girls don't, and those who do get in huge trouble. It's a rich text. I'm really looking forward to talking it over.
Yeah, I'm so glad we have Mariah here to bring the historical context, because I certainly didn't have it going into this movie, although I did know about what happens to Melanie at the end, because just in planning this pairing, it kind of came up, you know? This was also my first time seeing the film, Scott, and so I went into it with that knowledge, but also some awareness of the beach party films of the era. My mom was a big Gidget fan, so we watched a lot of Gidget growing up. So going into it knowing how the film resolves, it was really kind of interesting to track the character of Melanie, like from beginning to end, and sort of especially how interested she is in Merritt's like speech in class in the beginning, and just, you know, her first date with Dill. Like, I think that could just blow over your head if you weren't, you know, looking for it, you know, what it's insinuated pretty heavily to happen there. So on the one hand, I can like see how it would be interesting to like go into this film and be completely surprised by it. But I do think it is, as Keith says, kind of a richer text if you know what it's doing and can kind of track how it gets there.
I have kind of a question for Mariah, just based on the sort of context for this movie, is like, would an audience be surprised by the places this film goes? I mean, because you were saying there was this period where films did kind of go to some dark places, but at the same time, this is a film that promises kind of a wacky beach adventure. I mean, even in the trailers at the beginning of the film, you know, in the scene with the cop telling the other cops that all this wild stuff is going to happen. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a film that's going to get as dark as it gets.
Yeah, I think that based on, if you were only going at this movie based on the trailer, you would probably be surprised. But people who were familiar with the book, I think, and it was a pretty popular book, not as popular as like Peyton Place, where you knew that was, you knew what you were getting with Peyton Place, or even The Best of Everything. But I do think it would have been a little less surprising, just given this was coming in the midst of several films that were doing that combo of like frothy comedy and like incest or date rape. It was actually, date rape was really common in a lot of these late 50s films. It happens in, or unplanned pregnancy, another huge like topic in a ton of films, like A Summer Place. It's another one with like young lovers, you know, and it does not go well for them. So I think it would be a little less shocking, especially because obviously it hadn't been sanitized into the Beach Party movies yet. So I think coming, I think it's also, is it Joe Pasternak, right? Yeah. Knowing his track record, I think a savvy moviegoer at least would have known that they were going to get a mixture of the froth and the darkness, because that's just sort of a type of movie that was really popular at the time. And even going all the way back to Three Coins and a Fountain, like generally all of these movies where it's like a group of girls trying, you know, their newfound freedoms, one of the girls always ends up either with a heartbreak, an unplanned pregnancy, death, or rape. Like that just, it always happened. If you saw a group of four girls, other than like How to Marry a Millionaire, right? But that's a little bit earlier in the 50s. This is just, I think, par for the course for a lot of these kind of, I like to call them like girls abroad melodramas, is sort of a subgenre. Usually it's like Rome Adventure or something where they're going to Europe, or Three Coins and the Fountain is also a European one. So having it be the abroad being Florida is kind of fascinating to me.
And it even starts with that like really kind of anthropological voice over like this exotic locale, yeah, of Fort Lauderdale.
I think Florida hadn't really taken off yet, yeah, you know, like,
well, this is pre-Disney World.
I think it's kind of a cause and effect thing too. I think it was happening and this helped popularize, yeah, it. And mm-hmm, you know,
same with a film that came later, Palm Springs Weekend, that made Palm Springs kind of into the West Coast destination for young people looking for frisky trouble. It's another one too, where the guy is, the thing I like about Palm Springs Weekend a little bit more than this one is the, like, the Yaleys that are the rapists in this one. There's not a lot of development there, and you don't really see why suddenly, I mean, any person really can be a rapist, obviously, but there's not a lot of signaling of that. Whereas in Palm Springs Weekend, like, the guy is, like, you know, he's a predator from the get. And then when it happens, you're like, okay, I knew this was going to happen. Which is, I think, how you see the impact of this film, where it probably did like throw a few people for a loop. So they, you know, the later films, they kind of let you know earlier, like, this guy's going to rape someone.
I mean, I will say in this one, I feel like the moment where Dill? Turns up at her door and she just immediately knows what's going to happen is just such a harrowing, shocking moment that, of course, obviously, if you'd follow those guys any closer, you'd kind of miss the impact of that moment. Yeah. might have been lost.
That's true.
I'm actually curious to ask you, you have this on Blu-ray, as you say, Mariah, what is it about this film that you think is special? What makes it sort of stand out among films of its kind?
I think because each of the girls, even though they're kind of stereotypes, like, each of the girls are so well formed for the stereotypes that they are. So, like, Dolores Hart's, lack of a better word, she's the good girl, but she's like the most feminist of them. She's, you know, talking about sex right away. She's talking back. She's this intelligent person. You probably can tell she has some sort of plan for her life, or at least is attempting to have a plan for her life. Paula Prentice is, I think, just one of those could only exist in the 60s kind of presence. That's why she's kind of retired from acting after a while. But every time she shows up in a movie, I'm just like, yes, we're getting her really frenetic form of comedy, which doesn't always work, but I think works really well in this. Like, I don't think anyone else could have said, I plan to be a walking baby maker, and it wouldn't have been cringy. Like, you're like, okay, yeah, I see it.
Yeah. I love her. And like, that was the moment where it's like, this is so kind of like connects with the Stepford Wives, where she's sort of the rebellious, yeah, person who becomes a Stepford Wife. It's like she has that person, she already has that rebellious personality, but she's already speaking Stepford Wives lines. Yeah. It's very strange.
She's like that in Bachelor in Paradise, which is a great Lana Turner movie that I love. And she plays Lana Turner's neighbor who's like got the hots for Bob Hope, the titular bachelor. And she's hilarious in that too. And then I just really love Yvette Mimou. I feel like she's such a tender screen presence. Like, every movie she's in, she's just, you kind of want to protect her, but you don't ever feel like it's coming from a false place. It always feels like she's just truly this like new soul on screen. So then when she gets, when she's the person who gets her heart crushed and like her body literally crushed, it's like extra hard to watch. But also, you know, you're just like, maybe this time she'll make good choices. And it's like, she shouldn't have to make the good choices. You know, yeah. I think that role just really plays well, because like you can read it as and there's some really bad feminist readings of this movie where it's like it's her choices that are the problem, and it's like, no, it's literally not her choices. But it shows, I think, really well that she's somebody who, like, in this transitional period between teenagers sort of having this freedom to explore their sexuality, if you're coming out of the Eisenhower era where they're not teaching you literally anything, you have professors who won't even talk about it. Of course, you're going to have someone like her not realize that, like, these guys are not good. They're up to no good, because she's, you know, she's been taught that, like, oh, if I do what the guy wants, he'll marry me. Like, that's what she's been raised on. And I think she really sells that naivete in a way that is honest and not calculated.
We're forgetting Connie Francis.
I mean, yes. What can you say about Connie Francis? She's amazing.
She's really fun. And like, she's obviously playing the comic one, but there's a subtext where it's like, she's supposed to be ugly, which I was not getting.
She's the athlete. Yeah. You're like,
okay,
you're
sure.
Like, she's hockey, so too. Cute.
Like, gosh.
To go back to the character of Melanie and Yvette Mimou and the way she just exudes a certain innocence, naivete, whatever you want to call it, like, I do find the way this film pairs her with the character of Merritt so interesting, mm-hmm. in that I think it's possible to read it as like Merritt influencing her into these situations, these quote unquote bad choices that she makes. And if I'm being ungenerous, I think that's like what the filmmakers maybe intended, you know, rather than this sort of all men are bad reading that we can bring from a more modern perspective. And like, I do think like that is there as well, but I think it's a little harder to parse in between, like, the you know, all these guys get, not all of them, but most of them get like charming moments too, especially Ryder and TV, you know, gets very quickly forgiven and redeemed in the end, you know. So I think, like, I don't want to put it in necessarily in the context of like where this film is placing blame, but I think like it is maybe encouraging you to make a connection between the ideas that Merritt is espousing at the beginning and what ends up happening to Melanie, especially, you know, in their scene at the end where Merritt is so upset and contrite and seems to feel guilty.
Yeah.
You know, like, she never like comes out and says it. But I think that's maybe how we're supposed to read that.
I agree. I think she definitely is like espousing a lot of things that she's not living by, because mm-hmm. she's like, I don't know, it's hard to read if she's supposed to be like fearful, or, you know, like, she's just stuck in that same limbo where she knows she has these freedoms, but she has like hesitation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's unclear if the hesitation comes from a moral standpoint of like, I should stay a virgin, or if it just comes from fear of the freedom. It's kind of on the line there in the dialogue. Whereas Melanie, I think, is willing to embrace it, but in a way that she thinks, oh, if I go to bed with this person once, that means we're married, right? Which is that mm-hmm. old school, you know, save us to marriage. Well, this is the new marriage in her brain, I guess.
Emotional intimacy.
Yeah. And you're like, oh no, because, you know, this is like the beginning of modern day hookup culture where you've been, you know, just 10 years later, less than 10 years later, what is 7 years later, you had just like orgies in the middle of fields and stuff. But like, they're all this generation that's just stuck. And, you know, I love that Merritt learns that, like, you can't espouse these things without, you know, giving foundations and giving, like, advice. And, like, you know, you can't just, like, be the leader and then actually not have any experience. Like, that's not helpful to anybody. But to that point at the beginning, like, neither is the professor. Like, the professor is not helping anybody either. And that's her job.
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is about context. And what's interesting about that first scene is there are no boys there, you know, mm-hmm. it's all the women, and the danger of these, you know, views that she's espousing, they become dangerous when you insert the men into it and everything they bring to this context, and the predatory aspect. It, like, the women in that room, they don't have the tools to even like think about that at this point. And then they're dumped into this Fort Lauderdale situation where it's 80% guys who are on the prowl, you know, and that is not
80%.
That's what it says. Yeah, it says 80%.
It says it's 80% men. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Did I say 80% of that? No, 100% of the 80%.
No, I think 98% of the 2% are dialectical jazz musicians.
Right.
That's how it breaks down. I think it's so crazy. I'm not sure there's any better encapsulation of the 60s than the fact this is 1960. In 1968, Yvette Mimieux in a movie called Three in the Attic, in which she's one of three women trying to punish someone by having exhausting them sexually. It's just a wild change of mores across just a few years there.
Yeah, it really, I think this is one of those films that started to break down what a film could be, you know, it's sanitized compared to the book, but it's still like you were all shocked watching it, right? Because you're like, oh, 1960, they wouldn't do any of this. And yet I think it's fascinating to watch these films that aren't quite after the code has fallen down, but like they're like chipping really heavily away and seeing what they can slip in that doesn't even have to be subtext anymore.
I felt like the film was kind of missing the Castro angle, though. I feel like that would have just brought it to another level.
Honestly, I would have loved to see the version of this that kept that in there, like these, because the one thing that girls are missing is, and truly this generation I think would have had, is a little bit of a political consciousness. We wouldn't have had all that upheaval, I think, in the 60s without that generation. You're starting to have more women go to college for degrees. You're starting to have more women in the workforce. You would have more women in thinking politically.
They're going actually, to jazz clubs. They're jazz clubs.
Yeah, I mean, right. Like that, I think that's the main thing that's missing, and that's unfortunate. And a bit weird to me that I think it was Pasternak that said like there should be no politics in cinema. And I'm like, that's like antithetical to the beginnings of cinema, but you can have, you know, rape. You just can't have politics. It's like, okay. Cool.
I hate to break it to him, but there's politics in this movie.
Yeah.
There's plenty of sexual politics. So to go back to that character of Merritt in that scene at the beginning, because it really does kind of set the stage for the movie. Like, where does she end up? You know, because she comes in this way, you know, because they're speaking in abstraction at the beginning. And Merritt, of course, has been thinking a lot about this, and she's kind of rebelling against an older line of thought. But I think there's kind of has to be an evolution on her part that comes through what she experiences with her friends and also what she experiences on her own with Ryder, the George Hamilton character. Then you get to that scene in the hospital, which is quite striking, where she's just like, have you met any good men lately or something like it's I have it in the keynote. It's just it really is a standout moment where it's like she just doesn't, she's done feeling generous with any of these guys who have just allowed this that something like this could happen. That's a very striking, you know, end point to where we began, even though obviously the film ends in a very happy note. Her thoughts seem much have to be more complicated by the end.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that happens right when she is about to actually finally go to bed with this guy. Like, she's finally like, I'm going to do it. And then her best friend is like in the hospital. And suddenly she's like, fuck all men. How she ends up back with George Hamilton's character at the end, I feel like doesn't quite work for me. Yeah. Like, oh, you're a nice guy because you're going to drive us home. Like, okay.
He's very contrite.
I mean, Frank Gorshin's character is the best man in the movie. I mean, is he the only like non-awful man in the movie?
I mean, he's kind of awful. He keeps calling her short one.
Yeah, well, it's true.
And he shows no real interest in Angie until like he can't see. It's implied, you know? Like,
yeah.
No, I mean, they're all bad.
I want to root for TV because, you know, but he just blows it every time. Every time he kind of gets back on the right track, he blows it. Awesome hats aside, not a whole lot going on.
I would blow it for TV. Barbara Nichols, though, so I get it. Like, I would too.
Really? I just saw this sort of like kind of not great Marilyn Monroe.
I love her. She's so fun. She's one of my favorites.
You love her here or
no,
just
in all of it. Like in all her movies. She has I think she does like, I know she gets compared to Marilyn Monroe, but I don't think she's necessarily, by the time she knew she wasn't Marilyn Monroe, I feel like she had her own sort of like Wario version that she was doing that really works for me.
this is the aqua dancer we should note for our listeners that we're speaking of, that TV cannot resist.
You're referring to Lola Fandango is who you're referring to.
Oh my God.
The Fishbowl Girls were also very popular in the 50s. Fun fact, my great aunt Zay was offered to be a Fishbowl Girl in a hotel here in Chicago because she lived in Chicago for a while, and she politely declined because she was pregnant. So it was a very, like, very popular attraction in, like, fancy hotels to have Fishbowl Girls. It was a thing.
Did she have any sort of, like, training or special skills, or was it?
Yeah, she was a showgirl. She was a showgirl.
Okay. Okay. So it wasn't just like, you're pretty, throw you in a tank of water.
She was really beautiful. I mean, she's still really beautiful. She's in her 90s now, but like I almost wish we still had them because it seems really fascinating.
There's still the Weeki Wachee mermaids in Florida.
Oh, I remember that
from the 80s when I went through with my parents, and like they're still there. I just looked them up. But I think that's probably the last surviving mermaids, endangered species.
The Fishbowl Girls, yeah.
All right. So, you know, this is a film that is written, produced, directed by men, based on a novel by another man. Does that feel obvious to you at times? And are there moments like the one where you're talking about at the water show that perhaps don't play as lighthearted as intended?
Yeah. I think yes.
Next question.
Is it just completely obvious from first frame to last that no women were involved in the creation of this movie beyond who the people on the screen?
Yeah, I think part of it is they almost get there with the recurring joke of like more and more girls on the floor. That's the closest I feel like they get to showing like the intimacy that girls mm-hmm. often do in groups or feel comfortable to have that many women in a room where they feel pity and the comfort. But I don't think they quite get to the intimacy that they would have been way more helping each other with their hair and the bras and like trying on each other's clothes and like our partnered movie shows. Yeah. And I think this movie gets close in that aspect, but everywhere else, it's like, I don't ever really feel like these girls, like, I don't know why they're friends. I don't know what they like about each other. You know, I feel like there's like little tiny details that just aren't there.
I did really love the ever expanding population of floor girls as like a gag, but you're right that like it's really just kind of like a reset point, not like any, like there's not really any storytelling happening in that room, or any character building, I guess I should say, happening in that room. This has a very like made by as the father of daughters to feel to, yes. to me. There's a well-intentionedness to it and like a sort of assumption that you understand something profound about women that is being brought here. But there's also just a whiff of like, you know, moralizing, didactism, instruction, you know, like how to behave, basically, that it all comes back to in the end. So it doesn't really seem interested in wrestling with womanhood outside of the context of marriage, you know, heterosexual relationships.
Yeah, I don't think it also really shows what this, like, it shows what that freedom does by the mistakes they make mm-hmm. expressing it, right? But it doesn't show how they really feel about
it's
experiencing
not celebrating
the freedom. Yeah, exactly. And that, I think, would have made it a really, really special film, because that it really is like a turn in adolescence in America, and it feels lacking to not show the interior of it, as opposed to just, oh, now they can do this, oh, now they can do that. Which is kind of why, if you've seen The Best of Everything, I don't think the movie is as good as the book in doing it, but the book is written by Rona Jaffe. You do get a lot more interiority of these girls and their young adults in that one. They're like in their first jobs. You get a lot more of the interiority and the conversations. And I wish this movie had more of that, as opposed to all the conversations being about men. That would have been nice.
Well, I mean, so let's look at the other side. Let's look at who these filmmakers would be experts on, the men. what do you think of the men on offer here? Because we have our fake Yaleys who are vile. But what about Ryder, TV, and Basil?
I'm going to take it back. I think the best man in this movie is Chill Will's police captain. He seems level head on his shoulders.
Is he the one that's like, I wish I was dead at one point? Yeah, exactly. I laughed so hard that when I was rewatching it.
And that, but I mean, these guys, writer to TV, Basil, they're Bachelors number 1, 2, and 3. They seem like projects maybe to us, but are they in the film's eyes? Are these just good boys generally?
That's a good question.
I mean, I think Ryder is probably the most unambiguously, like, quote unquote, good guy. Like, yeah. he's got all the flaws that a red-blooded American male might have, you know, and I don't think he's ever presented as someone dangerous. Yeah. I don't think any of them are, any of the non-faux Yaleys are ever presented as someone dangerous. And that is an interesting choice in the context of kind of what I was talking about earlier, in that, like, this is a situation where, you know, the women should be on guard, you know, but they don't know to be on guard. And in the kind of presentation of these dudes as, like, well-meaning undercuts that idea, if the film even has it, which I don't believe it does. Yeah, and I think, like, they're all supposed to be seen as, like, various types of marriage material. Yeah. You know, you've got like the sure thing in Ryder. You know, he's rich, he's handsome, he's ostensibly a good guy, and you've got the fixer upper in TV, and then the dregs, what's left, I guess, in oh. Basil.
But he's the alt. He's your alt boyfriend,
right? Yeah,
yeah. your arty husband. Yeah,
it's pretty talented though. I mean, it's sort of generic West Coast jazz, but it's okay, you know.
I mean, I think Angie blows him out of the water. Like, I mean,
she's clearly the most.
I would have
talented.
Liked to see a little acknowledgement on his part of, like, hey, you really sang the hell out of that song that you made up off of the top of your head.
she's got a good voice. I did appreciate that one of the songs mentioned Satchel Paige. There's the acknowledgement that Black people do exist in the world. It's the only such acknowledgement in the film, best I can tell.
Yep.
Yeah.
So then basically the standard that is being set here for quality men is not dangerous. That is the bar. That is the bar that has to be exceeded. Mm-hmm. In which, I guess.
But, obnoxious, okay, but dangerous is not, I guess, is sort of where this film lands.
You know, but you look at some of these interactions between Merritt and Ryder. I mean, Ryder is pressuring her. I mean, like, he is kind of trying to get whatever he can out of her in a way that is, you know, pretty, a little dodgy, you know? It's not that, you know, and it makes her uncomfortable, you know? That, I mean, I think the film is pretty subtle, I guess, about that, and about her trying to figure out her drawing lines and pulling away and, you know, trusting him and a little bit, but maybe not all the way. I mean, I think that's handled in a fairly nuanced way to give the film some credit, I guess.
I would agree with that. And I think what the tension that's fascinating, and I don't know if it's purposeful, I would think probably in the book it's definitely there, is this idea of they are in this new place where, as she said, you can play house before you get married. However, there are still factors of American society that are going to judge you negatively should you do that, right? We're not in the free love era quite yet. We're not in Sex and the Single Girl. Like, that movie hasn't come out yet. That book hasn't come out yet. So there's still a little bit of judgment that this is the first generation. They're like that pioneering generation, at least the 30s, I think 20s, 30s, they also pioneered this. Like, the flappers were definitely sleeping around. But, like, there was a lot of repression in the 30s, 40s, 50s, right? So this is, like, this new generation openly going back to this, like, sexual freedom. But there's still that puritanical judgment. And so, like, someone like Merritt, who's from, I think she's from, like, Ohio or something, right? Her dad owns a drugstore. She knows that if she does sleep with this guy and he doesn't marry her, people in her life are probably going to judge her, right? She might even be judging herself. And I think that tension is really interesting and dated, but in a good way, like dated in a historical sort of artifact way of, like, those choices are still, you have the choice technically, you have that freedom technically, but there are ramifications beyond just like reputational ramifications are still there. And these girls are trying to, you know, navigate that without the help of literally any of these adults, because they're the ones, like, setting down the tension, creating that tension. It's really interesting. And I think, didn't she mention the Kinsey report, like, very briefly at the beginning, right? So it's before that was really embraced. Like,
it sends her to the dean's office. She's ready.
How dare you read the Kinsey report?
She may not be able to go back to school.
It's really a fascinating movie because it has all this fluff and then it has all this really serious stuff. And it's hard to decide how much of how politically interesting it is was purposefully politically interesting or just is in retrospect.
As far as that tension, I mean, I think it's almost all in that scene on the boat, which is such a standout scene. I'm the putt-putt. I'm sorry. Another kind of interesting element of that whole conversation is like her openness about going on a lot of dates and being frosh queen. Like, I don't know if there's like a deeper insinuation to frosh queen that I don't know about, but it's certainly like he certainly seemed to be like feeling out how permissive and experienced she is in that moment. So I guess like I will give Ryder a little bit of credit for like asking the questions and not just assuming. However, all of that credit is immediately stripped away when he has to point out that his IQ is 2 points higher than hers. And that's now he's dead to me again.
I also do like, to your point, like earlier in the first scene, she talks about all the different, like she calls it making out. And then she goes through literally what they called it in the 20s, what they called it in the 30s, what they called it in the 40s. Like my mom went to school in the 60s, so she would have been a little bit younger than these girls, but she still called it petting. Because I think her mom called it petting. And I'm like, what? But, you know, like there's like the musical with the Petting in the Park song and whichever Busby Berkeley musical that is. Like, it, I think what's fascinating about this is like it makes it very clear that they are not, these are not the first generation of college girls to like minimum do some, you know, second base stuff maybe, right? But they're the first generation that are openly doing it. Like this is like the everyone, they're just out on the street, they're in the sand, you know, and I think it's an interesting way of showing that like this isn't as radical as it seems. It just seems radical because they weren't really able to show it in movies for decades because of the production code. American society in general was like, oh, you can have sex, but like keep the door shut, like don't let people know you're making out in public, like, you know, PDA was looked down on. And like suddenly you, by the end of the 60s, again, you have like naked people like fucking in San Francisco's parks and things, right? And this is that kind of that watershed of like, we know we've always been doing it, you know, grandma made out with grandpa, like we're just gonna show that we're doing it now. And I think that's an interesting aspect of this movie. Part of the reason I like rewatching it is just seeing all the different ways that it sort of is that key between what was happening but hidden and what is happening and not hidden anymore. Just every time I watch it, there's always like a new little line that I didn't notice.
It's also like, it's kind of genuinely funny in some places. like I said, like I did like the gag of there like always being more girls on the floor, and TV as, you know, kind of much of a cad as he ends up being is, you know, a funny presence. I guess it's not an unfunny movie for, you know, all its serious aspects. So I guess I want to give it its due in that respect.
Yeah, and Connie Francis is great. Like, she really is like a little Judy Garland. She's like such a fun presence. But again, she's like the fun girl, so she's not the one you date. It's like that's annoying.
So I wanted to get into the setting a little bit, because that's kind of a big attraction to this film, and also, you know, a bit of fascination for us kind of looking back on Fort Lauderdale as it's depicted here in the early 60s and maybe what we know about it now. What stood out for you? I mean, what about how men and women relate to each other in this setting, and you know, what elements, I guess, of the film are period specific and which ones are kind of evergreen when it comes to this slice of spring break mayhem / paradise?
I feel like the bikinis are evergreen. Mm-hmm. I know the bikinis were only like 10 years out in the market, I think, at this point, 15 years, something like that. But like they're always in bikinis. These girls are always showing their belly buttons. Like that's definitely
their back. Like, there's like one shot of, I think, is it Tuggle or it might be Merritt. Like she has like a backless dress on. It's just like, it's really good.
It's very racy. Yeah. Like a lot of skin in this. It seems tame today, but like there's a lot of skin in this movie for 1960. I think that's fascinating. And there's some of those bikinis are so cute, not to get too girly, but like I was like, I wish I had
so many fit and flare dresses. Like it's
her like pink play suit that she, you know, I want that play suit so bad.
As far as the setting, I just want to clarify, like this is mostly sets, right? I'm sure the hotel is. And I think maybe like the opening and closing shots of the beach are maybe location, but like everything else seems very set-like to me.
There's a few shots of the, like all the traffic there by the beach. That's obviously shot on location. I really treasure all the location stuff that is in this. And I think it is well deployed to give the illusion that you're somewhere you're not. But like at the end, there's a shot of Merritt and Ryder on the beach. And then they immediately could tell that they're just on a set with just sand on it, you know? Movies.
Yeah.
It's the illusions they create.
But they did do the world premiere at Fort Lauderdale, and on the Blu-ray, you can watch
it. Oh, really?
It's like a two-minute newsreel of the world premiere in Fort Lauderdale.
I went looking for like how this was received in the Fort Lauderdale newspaper, and like the review of it is like really boring and not you know, local specific at all. And it's just sort of like, this is a pretty funny movie, which it's weird. I'm glad Bosley Crowther got it, which is, he didn't always get it, but he seems to get it with this one a little bit.
I thought I read that the elbow room, the bar, is an actual bar from the area. Can anyone back me up on that?
But it wasn't like, she wouldn't have been shot there, right? It was just sort of like...
No, but it's like a reference to an actual local place. And yeah, as far as like the beach scenes, and I did love the visual of just like not even being able to see the beach for all the crowds and the cars going by, also kind of foreshadows maybe a little bit what happens to Melanie. And I mean, like the introduction of Basil foreshadows it to a certain extent too, with nearly running over Tuggle out in front of the crowded beach. But yeah, I mean, the way the beach itself is portrayed, like, I don't think there's any actual location shooting at a beach here. Is there? Like, I think it's just like we get those shots of the street.
Yeah.
And then sand shots, but I could be wrong.
The second unit had themselves a weekend. There's some helicopter shots at the beginning. You know, they got a little street. They got some street scenes, and then the rest is movie magic, I guess.
They call it good.
Yeah, very pre-Steadicam helicopter shots too. It's like I was a little nervous those opening shots. We're going to be okay.
This is helicopter about to just go into the. Crash into the water, but it's nice, you know, you get to see like the these beach towns, they have these little canals and stuff where people live, and yeah, it seems nice. But Fort Lauderdale will get a little rowdier over time, though. I do know that, but things are going to get quite rowdy, I would say, in our next pairing, so we're going to wait until next week to bring Where the Boys Are back, when we talk about the new film How to Have Sex. Until then, we're going to get into feedback. Now it's time for feedback. But before we get into it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. As we record this, Adam and Josh recently recorded an episode asking the impossible question of which Alfred Hitchcock masterpiece is superior, Rear Window or Vertigo? Seems like a trick question. They also break down the new Vietnamese film Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell. As for feedback, Vertigo. What's this? Vertigo.
You raised the question. I'll just say Vertigo.
Yeah.
I love
the correct answer is Under Capricorn. I actually really like that movie. I also have that on Blu-ray.
Mariah's on Under Capricorn Island over there. She's got a nice beach, nice setup there. Nice.
It's just pure sand beaches.
If we want to get into it, I think I remember on Film Spotting appearance once, Mariah, you said that you don't particularly care for Hitchcock at all. So this is...
No, I don't. I have a handful that I like.
All right, that's a whole other podcast.
I just took my kids to see Rear Window at a music box, and it was a glorious experience. It was their first. It was like the perfect. It's a my first Hitchcock kind of experience, and so it was theirs, and they loved it. As for feedback,
I saw that with my wife. Oh, okay,
oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
I saw it at the music box with my wife before we decided to move to Chicago. It certainly was. I don't think it tipped us over necessarily, but it's definitely a selling point to moving to Chicago. It's like, oh, what a theater!
I'm wearing my music box shirt right now. It's Marlene Dietrich.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's from the, I don't know if they're selling these anymore, but it's they had these Marlene Dietrich shirts on sale a couple years ago. And I was like, get one for me, Robert. And so he did.
Yeah.
I missed the music box. so much.
It's still there. It's
I know, still, but oh, I'm not.
You're not there. You're not there. That's the problem. Okay.
As for feedback, we always say we like it when our listeners write in about anything film-related. Listener Isaac wrote a very long and thoughtful email about his objections to film rating systems, though he appreciates the Kosky family tradition of blurting out a number between 1 and 10 in the car after a movie. We love that. That's coming back. That's a guarantee that's coming back because we had a good time doing that ourselves, which you mentioned it. So we can't read his letter in full, but Keith, do you want to share an excerpt?
All right, quick. Kosky family method. Vertigo. 3, 2, 1. I'm going to say 10.
10, yes.
All right, no, only me? Only me? Okay, all right, fine.
No, that's 10 for me.
Getting back to the letter. Sure, Isaac writes, not only is film rating reductive, it is inherently flawed. If I rate Citizen Kane and Airplane both 5 stars, does this mean that they are equal films operating on the same level? Every film one rates must enter into a network of relation if one attempts to claim objectivity, which, of course, one cannot. Each rater devises their own system. But how much weight do you give to a plot versus production design, especially when a film itself may weigh them differently? There are far too many factors to take into account, especially when funneled into a single number. I believe context about a critic is essential too, even beyond evident biases like, quote, a certain strain of white man hates Barbie and Saltburn, unquote. If I read a rated review on Letterboxd and then click on that user, I can see all their other ratings, not to mention what they have and haven't seen, which really highlights their relevance or lack thereof to my own taste. I'm also resistant to internet ratings in general, which turn us into consumers who either A, wisely identify a product that is worth our precious limited time and money, or B, get cheated by hawkers of faulty merchandise. How can art be assessed in this sense? Films deal in qualities, not quantities, emotions, not functions. I believe that a movie may be worth watching for a single scene, even a single moment.
It's an abrupt ending. It was a long email. Sorry.
There's a lot of meaty stuff in there. I think we brought this up before. It's like, you know, I feel like Necessary Evil is such a cliche, but I almost feel like ratings are I always think of rating systems like, here's your way into the review. Look at this rating, but then read the whole review. And of course, you know, obviously I am correct. That is what everyone clicks through on every review of Rotten Tomatoes and does not just look at the tomato meter. Everyone does it the correct way, right?
I give that insight 3.5 out of 5. Keith, 3.5 out of 5.
Oh, that's generous. generous.
I would say this person, though, does kind of say here, if I read a rated review on Letterboxd and then click on the user, I can see all their other ratings. That sounds like that. I mean, that to me sounds like it's useful for something, isn't it? I mean, it can be a kind of a thumbnail sketch that you can kind of expand from. I don't know. I don't mind. I understand the objection to
that. But to the other part of his letter, like, you don't know what context they are making those ratings in and sure. What is important to them in a film or not, you know? So its usefulness is limited in that respect.
But it's always going to be, I mean, usually they're attached to something. If they're attached to nothing, then you're not going to get much of anything. But usually they're attached to some piece of opinion, yes. maybe they don't need to be attached. Maybe you just need to kind of read and glean what you're going to glean. And that's fine. It's not necessary. But I don't necessarily have an objection to them, I guess, as others might.
Mariah, do you have strong opinions one way or the other on ratings?
I have like split opinions. Opinion one is that with criticism, I don't like it. I just want to know what the writer is pulling from it. That's why like the New Yorker, like Richard Brody, never rates a movie, right? He's just pontificating. And sometimes he goes off on the randomest tangents. And I really enjoy that because I feel like I'm really engaging with him as a writer and he's really engaging with the film, right? So I don't like it when I have to put like, I rate a lot of my like beat at Roger Ebert for the most part is like the like C level movies, a lot of bad rom-coms, that kind of stuff, a lot of terrible sci-fi movies. But sometimes there's something really interesting and I'm like, I was really interested in this, but I can't in good consciousness on a 4 give it a 2 or 3. So I have to give it a 2.5 and then I have to decide is a 2.5 negative or rotten on Rotten Tomatoes. And I hate that. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But as a personal on a personal side, like on Letterboxd, where it's just like, this is me engaging with the film, not critically necessarily, but emotionally, because I'm an emotional person. I'm a water sign. I'm like June 30th, 19th, right in the middle of the year. I am the most emotional water sign you will find. And so I give a lot of fives if I just love a movie. Is it because sometimes they're terrible. Sometimes it's a terrible movie and I gave it 5 stars because I loved it.
Where's the Boys Are at?
I think I gave Where the Boys Are 4 on a 5 scale. So there you go. So like Citizen Kane has 5 stars and like, I don't think this is a terrible movie. It's actually a good movie, but Age of Adeline has 5 stars and I stand by that. They're both 5-star movies in Adeline. The world of Mariah. I have watched that movie probably as many times as I've watched Citizen Kane.
I think I gave that a positive review at the Dissolve and there were some very unhappy commenters.
It really is. It's a good movie. It's a good movie. But it really is, I think, not helpful in criticism because I think it creates a binary and a lot of people just look at the number or look at the star rating or the grade and they don't necessarily engage with the reading. And I think I agree with Isaac about that. Like, I think that has created problems. When it comes to like just fun, like social media style rating, like Letterboxd, I love it and I enjoy it.
I mean, this conversation is kind of making me think of another sort of, you know, divide, I guess, in this discussion, which is ratings as applied to films that most people haven't seen versus just mm-hmm. talking about like us rating Vertigo, you know, or like something that everyone's seen. And just like it's a way to kind of like establish your opinion on a known quantity in a discussion, whereas like a rating of a film out of can, you know, then it becomes a referendum on whether this is a movie worth seeing or not. And as I said in our first discussion, like I think ratings can be useful and fun as a entry into a broader discussion. And that's kind of what my family's rating system was. It's just like a starting point, you know. But when you bring this element of like recommendation into it, that's I think where it gets a lot trickier and a little more unsavory.
Yeah, and I think with more difficult films at film festivals, films that maybe take a couple of watches to really figure out what the film is doing, putting a grade on it, if you've only seen it once and you have festival brain, that can like jettison the whole movie for a bunch of people that might have actually liked it if they were able to engage with it without thinking, oh, well, so-and-so out of can gave it a C- or whatever, you know. I don't think it's necessarily helpful in every circumstances, but in other cases it is helpful. So that's why I don't have like a hard and fast. It's like sometimes rating is great. Sometimes it's terrible.
Ratings. Three stars.
Yeah. Complicated.
Well, the show review does get 5 stars from me. I love the show review. So that's another thing. So I wanted to share another piece of feedback, very short, about the film Self-Reliance, which we had recently paired with 10th Victim. Listener Russell... wrote simply, I love your show, but the choice of this movie must be the worst choice in the history of the show. And I guess my first response to this would be, Russell, it's January. we didn't have a lot of options.
Self-Reliance or 10th Victim?
Self-Reliance.
Okay, sure. All right.
But Russell had me going through the archives to see which new film might actually be the worst. The criteria for me is a film that nobody really liked or cared about, either on the show or in the public sphere. The three I came up with, Reminiscence, How to Build a Girl, and Baywatch. Those are, I think those are all worse. What do you think? Did you all go plumbing through the archives as I did?
So the one that immediately came to mind was How to Build a Girl, because I didn't think it was very good, and I did not learn how to build a girl watching this film. It was really successful on two levels.
Baywatch was the first one that came to mind for me, but I don't regret doing it because we paired it with the Brady Bunch movie, which is an all-time favorite. So it was worth it just for that. The only other one I debated raising was The Meg, but I feel like you can't really make an argument for that not having a cultural footprint since it got a sequel.
The Meg?
We did Jaws and The Meg.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it just paled in comparison to Jaws. Who can say, but
it did pale in comparison to Jaws. This is true. Reminiscence, though, man. What Reminiscence?
I don't think I was on that one. I don't recall, so I wasn't on Baywatch.
I've never seen Baywatch, so should I watch Baywatch? Is that what you're saying?
No, just watch Brady Bunch movie again.
Okay. That's really bad. But the Brady Bunch factor did make that a fun pairing. So that's the part of it too. It's just like maybe we could do something cool with it, you know, when the film is weak. And I think that was the Self-Reliance thing too. It was fun to talk about the 10th Victim.
I kind of like Self-Reliance. It definitely was not the worst film we've done. Made me laugh.
I think I was coldest on it of everyone. But like in a lot of these examples, like How to Build a Girl, we paired with Almost Famous. Baywatch, we paired, like I said, with Brady Bunch movie. Meg, we paired with Jaws. What do we pair Reminiscence with?
Eternal Sunshine. Pretty good movie.
Eternal Sunshine. Yeah. So like all of these are being put up against like classic movies. That's the premise of the podcast, obviously. But, you know, in the case of Self-Reliance, it's being put next to 10th Victim, which is like it's more of an oddity than a necessarily a stone cold classic the way all those are. I mean, maybe some would argue against Brady Bunch movie. I certainly wouldn't. But yeah, so I think like that, like it lowers them even more sort of in the calculus when you see like what we compared them to, I guess. It just they pale even more by comparison.
Well, we won't do it again. But we will never, you know, of course we'll do it again.
No, only good movies. 3.5 stars or above from here on out.
That's right. And we don't know what we're getting into sometimes. We just like, you know, this looks like what might be good for us. Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts or recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response in a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about the new British indie film How to Have Sex and once again bring Where the Boys Are back into the discussion. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and at Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, if you find yourself in the 1960s and a hitchhiker asks if you can bang on your pipes and lift a few cans together, don't worry, he just wants to call you for a beer.